This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It was the last week of April, and this week it wasn't just Georgia. A number of states have been moving toward reopening, including Colorado, whose Democratic governor, Jared Polis, has been aggressive about trying to get the state back open for business. The mayor of Las Vegas says she wants people back in casinos. But the debate over the when and the what of reopening has gotten a little bit ahead of the how. What are states doing to ensure that when they reopen, they'll be able to stay open without the epidemic just going back to where it was before? And just because you open your doors doesn't mean anyone will walk through them. A key ingredient for any successful reopening is public confidence that it is safe to go out, and opinion polls show we're not really close to that yet. Later on today's show, Dr. Ashish Jha, director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, will join us to talk about how reopening is set to go and what we need to be doing but aren't to get from this lockdown to a new normal. But now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Christine Emba, columnist at the Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So Joe Biden appeared on MSNBC's Morning Joe this Friday, addressing personally for the first time an allegation that he sexually assaulted a Senate staffer in 1993. Tara Reid, a former intern coordinator in Biden's Senate office, said he took her aside in a semi-private area of the Capitol complex and digitally penetrated her. Reid had come forward last year as one of several women who said Biden's excessive touchiness or invasions of personal space had made her uncomfortable. She said she had made a complaint about sexual harassment in his office and had been pushed out in retaliation. In recent months, she has added this much more serious allegation, and at least one associate of Reid's, a former neighbor, says Reid told her about this specific allegation long ago, just a couple of years after the alleged incident. Biden says the allegation is simply not true, that he did not do this. Christine, has Biden's response here been satisfactory?
This is such a complicated issue, but I think that at least in what he said on Morning Joe, Biden generally did what he needed to do. He came out and personally spoke, so not just through a campaign surrogate or through advisors. He unequivocally denied the allegations. Crucially, he did not go on the attack. He didn't question her motivations or attempt to disparage Tara Reid in any way. And he did say that he would open up the National Archives records so that they could try and find any employment records or reports she may have filed. What I did still have some quibbles with, though, was the fact that he seemed uninterested in opening up the Senate records that are kept at the University of Delaware, so his sort of personal records of his time in the Senate. I had some questions about that, but overall, I think in what he said this morning, I think Joe Biden did what he needed to do at the moment.
Rich, what do you think?
Yeah, he made a categorical denial. I think the problem here has been less Biden's performance than the media's performance, which has been grossly hypocritical. It took weeks and weeks for anyone even to ask Biden about this. And the disparity of the treatment of Tara Reid with Brett Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, is just stark and inexcusable. And the toughest part of Biden's interview on Morning Joe was when Mika Brzezinski, to her credit, asked him about the hypocrisy. He was part of this idiotic, you must believe all women brigade, a standard that's deeply illiberal and unfair. And he has no explanation why, by his own standard, Tara Reid shouldn't be believed. So that was always, though, a foolish standard. I said in the Brett Kavanaugh case, I say now, what we need to do is look to see if there are any contemporaneous notes or record or witnesses. You need to look for the consistency in the accuser's story. You need to look to see if there's any pattern on a part of the accused. And there's some contemporaneous indications of this. There's the suggestive call that Tara Reid's mother allegedly made to Larry King. There's this neighbor you referenced. So some of that, nothing is definitive. Her story hasn't been consistent at all. And although Biden, we all know, has been handsy and engaged in weird stuff, smelling women's hair and things of that nature, there's never been an allegation of this kind of seriousness. So I think you have to be skeptical of her story and certainly not say there's enough evidence there to convict Biden in the court of public opinion.
Sorry, I just want to jump in really quickly and clarify something, because this is a statement that continues to recur in conservative media on the right and in people who want to discredit or be skeptical of the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement never said, believe all women. There is no believe all women standard that anyone is trying to hold the Me Too movement to. That is a misstatement, and it's false, and it's used to discredit the movement. The actual line that is repeated by people who support the Me Too movement is not believe all women, it is believe women, which means that when women come forward and say that something has happened to them, that they have been assaulted, that they should be taken at face value, that they should be listened to, that they should be taken seriously, that their complaints should be investigated rather than swept under the rug and ignored. Anyone can make a false claim, that's clear. We're not necessarily saying that anything any woman ever says is automatically true. And that's a misstatement that's being used in this case by Rich here to say that Joe Biden is being a hypocrite right now, but that's a misstatement of the entire movement.
But so the statement that Biden made in the context of the Blasey Ford accusations against Brett Kavanaugh, Biden said, quote, for a woman to come forward in the glaring lights of focus nationally, you've got to start off with the presumption that at least the essence of what she's talking about is real. So, I mean, doesn't that standard apply here? And wouldn't that mean that, you know, by Biden's own standard, people should presume that he did something along the lines of what Tara Reid says he did to her?
I mean, I think that's an important thing to bring to focus. And I want to say here also that I do not necessarily believe that Tara Reid is lying or saying something untrue. I think, in fact, that the media and many of the people who immediately stepped up to say either unequivocally, yes, she is telling the truth, or unequivocally, no, I don't believe her, simply don't have enough information to be making those statements. I think that prudence sometimes is missing in, yes, the media and, of course, these advisors and supporters. And when you don't know, you should say you don't know and not just make something up. I think that, you know, her claims should be investigated. There are inconsistencies in her claims. There are also, as Rich pointed out, some possible corroborations. Unfortunately, this is something that, you know, did take place a long time ago. It is always hard to adjudicate these claims. They definitely should be investigated. But ultimately, right now, we cannot say. I think the fact that she is being listened to in the media, even though it took a while, that Joe Biden is actively addressing these complaints, even though it, you know, has taken him a while, is satisfactory for where we are now until we have more information, which we're looking for.
But I'm sorry, this kind of modulated take on these sort of accusations was not what we heard in the Brett Kavanaugh case. It wasn't even close. You're stating my position pretty well on the Kavanaugh accusers. Yeah, if someone comes forward, let's consider it seriously and consider the evidence. But I was excoriated and attacked for saying that by people on the left. And as Mika Brzezinski, in the interview with Biden, pointed out, you have all these Democratic figures. They did not say that. They didn't come close to saying that. And the fact is that Tara Reid, although push comes to shove, I don't believe her. She has a stronger allegation than Christine Blasey Ford did. Yet you had the entire Democratic Party and the media bent on destroying Brett Kavanaugh's career over a weaker allegation, explicitly because she came forward, so it must be true. And that was a deeply illiberal and unfair standard. I'm glad people on the left are now reconsidering it, if they really are. But it was wrong what they did to Kavanaugh.
The issue about the idea that these things need to be investigated, and I'm not opposed to investigating them, is that in most cases, you're really not going to get a satisfactory conclusion to an investigation of an event like this that is alleged to have occurred a very long time ago with no direct witnesses. And most of the evidence that we can look at here, with the exception of that account from the former neighbor, is consistent with a number of different possible theories about what happened with Tara Reid in Joe Biden's office. That call to Larry King Live, which does seem to have been from Tara Reid's mother, is consistent with the story that Tara Reid was telling in 2019, that she had made a sexual harassment complaint in Biden's office well before she had said anything publicly about this sexual assault allegation. So I think, you know, that Christine, the thing is that I think when we get through whatever sort of investigation might be done here, we're very likely to be left about where we are now, where, as you say, we can't be confident for sure about whether this happened or not. And so doesn't that just leave people back in that same same position of having to try to evaluate for themselves with limited evidence their assessment of Biden's character, their assessment of Tara Reid's credibility. You can investigate, but we're going to be ending up in a position where people have to come to some sort of judgment without very much information.
Right. I think that's totally true. And I think that, you know, this is one of those places where we also have to think of the larger project and, you know, the kind of end goal in an election process, in the appointment of a Supreme Court justice. And so this is somewhere also where I think that conservatives and people on the right are kind of blurring the lines and perhaps trying to muddy the waters a little bit by invoking the Kavanaugh case here. As you say, Josh, we're probably not going to have that much new information even when we do an investigation. But we also have to think about the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh versus the election of a president. So yes, Brett Kavanaugh was asked to answer for these claims. People did not want him to be a Supreme Court justice. The fact is, there are lots of other people who could have been Supreme Court justices. It would not have been particularly difficult or harmful to, you know, remove him from that position because of questions of probity, which are important to Supreme Court justices, and nominate someone else in his place. That was entirely plausible and could have been easy. And that was part of the frustration, I think, coming from the left and Democrats at that time.
Well, Brett Kavanaugh is a person, and the idea that he just could have been it should have been easy for him to implicitly concede that he was guilty of this offense that he very likely did not commit, and for his reputation to be ruined forevermore, is ridiculous. And if this is the standard, it should apply to Joe Biden, too. He can easily drop out of the race tomorrow. There's nothing keeping him in this race. If just the very fact that there's an accusation creates a cloud around you such that you can't be in public life, he should go. And the Democrats can nominate Andrew Cuomo. They can nominate someone else. But again, this is a deeply unfair, illiberal standard. It shouldn't apply to pro-life conservatives. It shouldn't apply to pro-choice liberals. It shouldn't apply to anyone in the United States of America.
Christina, I'm confused about how a circle gets squared here for some of the Me Too advocates and for people on the left who had taken a standard. And I realize the standard was never believe all women, but it still seems to me that basically if you're looking at this and you say, you know, I've heard Tara Reid's accusation, Joe Biden has denied this, I support Joe Biden, the implication there is that you have weighed the very limited evidence available and you have decided that you find Joe Biden to be more credible than Tara Reid. And I think that is an appropriate thing to do. I have, you know, when I look at this, what I see basically is the accusation. Tara Reid says she had already been making complaints about sexual harassment in the office before Joe Biden committed this alleged assault, that he did this even in a position where she had been making complaints within the office about this matter during the Bob Packwood scandal, which is to say that the Senate was consumed by a sexual harassment scandal at this time. Senator Bob Packwood from Oregon, his career was imploding. There had been a New York Times story with 10 women making accusations of sexual harassment against him. And so this would have been a wildly reckless thing for Biden to have done in a semi-public area of the Capitol complex. And now I get that people do wildly reckless and predatory things. I'm skeptical about the idea that someone would do that not as a part of a pattern of behavior. And so if Joe Biden really was the sort of person who had done this to Tara Reid, I would have expected that there would be other allegations of similar nature. And so far, we haven't seen them yet. So that's my analysis of the situation. That's why I am inclined to believe Joe Biden when he denies this. But I still don't see how that's consistent with the believe women standard, where you're supposed to start with that presumption that when they come forward and say things like this, they're telling the truth. I mean, even now, Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York, said, you know, when we say we believe women, it's for this explicit intention of making sure there's space for all women to come forward and speak their truth to be heard. And in this allegation, that is what Tara Reid has done. If you're still supporting Joe Biden, I don't understand how that's consistent with the idea that you think what Tara Reid has done here is speak her truth. I mean, the implication here is that you think Tara Reid is lying.
Yeah, I mean, this is a difficult circle to square. I don't really think it can be done. I will say that one thing that I find frustrating in this situation is that the consequences for deciding who to believe, for taking a stand, for supporting Joe Biden or for supporting Tara Reid and saying that publicly are redounding on women rather than on Joe Biden himself. You know, we're talking about what Kirsten Gillibrand said. We're talking about what Nancy Pelosi said. We're talking about how Stacey Abrams acted. And women are the ones who are still, you know, being scrutinized and will suffer the negative consequences for whatever happened or didn't happen with Joe Biden, who is actually the person responsible here. And so I think that that is an unfortunate thing that bothers me. But in the end, I mean, this is, you know, this is a circular question. This is not a square that can be squared off, I suppose. I think my own approach here and what we all, I think, have to do responsibly is to look at the facts that we have on hand and the facts that we don't have on hand, to acknowledge that this is a troubling and painful thing to think about, that if you are a feminist, if you are supporting the Me Too movement, and yet, you know, the candidates that you have in front of you to vote for both have, you know, questions on their character. One is much worse. I think that we have to just name that and say, you know, we don't have the options we wish we had, but, you know, within this constrained set of options that we do have, what are the trade-offs that we're willing to make in pursuit of, you know, a better world? In the context of a constrained set of options, what would make the world a little bit better? I can't say what Joe Biden did or did not do in the past. I don't necessarily know who to believe or who to cast doubt on. But I can say that, you know, if I do have to vote for Joe Biden with this Tara Reid accusation, or Donald Trump with dozens of accusations against his name, caught on tape saying that he would sexually assault women, I still feel pretty confident that Joe Biden would be a better choice and would help women more going forward. I wish we had better options. I wish that, you know, the purity tests that we all, you know, like to make and talk about were clear and obvious here, but they aren't. So we have to live in the world.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Christine Emba of The Washington Post to talk about Justin Amash, libertarian candidate for president. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. So there's another candidate in the presidential race now, Congressman Justin Amash, who until fairly recently was a Republican from the Grand Rapids area of Michigan, is now a libertarian. He will run for president as a libertarian. And so there's been a lot of consternation, I think, especially from Democrats about this, basically saying, you know, you can't run as a third party candidate, you'll be a spoiler. You're taking votes away from Joe Biden, helping to reelect Donald Trump. Rich, I'm wondering what you make of that, because, I mean, Justin Amash is a founding member of the House Freedom Caucus. He unlike Gary Johnson, who was the libertarian nominee a few years ago, Justin Amash is pro-life, so he may be in a better position to appeal to certain crossover votes from social conservatives. And he has a vision for a much smaller government, much less spending than Donald Trump. So should Republicans be concerned at all that Amash will be taking votes away from Trump rather than from Biden?
I think they should be concerned. I don't know where I am on this question. I can see it both ways. I can see it suburban Republicans who can't abide Trump and might flip over to Biden, considering Amash an alternative to that and not voting for Biden. Or I can see him taking some votes from Trump. I guess my best guess is that ultimately he'll be pretty inconsequential and get less than 3% of the vote. Now, of course, you know, with real thin margins again and the blue wall states that Trump won last time, maybe that does make a difference. But I have kind of trouble sussing out with any certainty who would help or hurt.
Christine, what do you make of that? The concern among Democrats that Amash mostly hurts them.
Right. So according to CNN, Amash is getting around 2% of the vote nationally. And while he's still gaining attention, you know, it's novel that he's entered the race here. I think what we usually see with these third party candidates is that they get kind of weaker over time rather than stronger. I think it's more likely that he would probably take votes from Republicans who are, you know, extremely dissatisfied with Trump at this point, but still don't want to be Democrats, than Democratic voters who, you know, may not love Joe Biden, but definitely want Donald Trump out of office. I think when people enter the voting booths, You know, they are reluctant to kind of waste their votes on someone who they don't think will win. And I think Amash could play that role in the fall. But now it's a little bit early to say, frankly.
Christine mentions entering a voting booth, and I think that's an open question whether when we vote in November, we'll be doing that in voting booths. We're currently working toward the reopening of the country. And I want to bring in our next guest to talk about the outlook over the next few months as states try to return to something closer to normal, whether that will work and whether states and federal government are taking the steps they need to make that sustainable. We're joined now by Ashish Jha. Dr. Jha is director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Hello, Dr. Jha.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So as you look around at what states are doing right now, trying to ramp up testing, staffing up these contact tracing programs to identify people who may be exposed to the virus, how is all of that going? Are we going to be ready soon to resume a lot of normal activities?
So as you might imagine, this is going to vary from state to state. I think it's going, to my mind, kind of surprisingly slowly. Like, we knew we had to do this all through April, and it feels like just in the last few days, some of the states have really started getting religion and starting to get going. So I'm worried that most states are going to end up opening without having the infrastructure in place to stay open.
And so what is that going to look like? Do you expect them to sort of reopen and then you'll start seeing resurgent epidemics? They'll have to close again. What does it look like if you do that without the infrastructure?
Yeah. So, you know, the basic biology of this virus is the moment you open up and you start having more human-to-human interaction, the number of cases will start rising. So, like, that's to be expected, and that's going to happen. And the question is, how many cases are you going to have? How ready are you? How quickly can you respond to those things? And states that don't have much infrastructure in place, they're going to fall behind quickly. And they're going to have a very hard time catching up. This is a virus that is really unforgiving if you fall behind. That's what happened to us in February, March. So I worry that some states will have to end up shutting down again. Other states where they have a low number of cases, maybe they have pretty good testing infrastructure, they should be able to keep up. And then the wild card in all of this is the weather and whether the summer months are going to end up helping us a little or a lot. And if they end up helping us a lot, then even states that are not doing this in a super smart way may end up getting through it without a big resurgence. But I'm not banking on that.
Rich, as we've had this sort of political conversation about reopening, which has ended up with this remarkably strong red-blue component to it, even though, you know, I don't think that maps perfectly. You have Colorado, for example, where the Democratic governor has been really pushing toward reopening. But it feels to me like a lot of this stuff about, you know, how is the reopening going to work? Are we ready to stamp out resurgences? It feels like that's gotten lost in a lot of the public conversation. Do you see state governments focusing on that?
It has taken a backseat, and you would have hoped, you know, the reason why we did lockdowns in the first place, right, is one, we didn't want the hospitals to be overwhelmed, and they got to the brink in a couple places in New York and New Jersey, but that nightmare scenario has been averted, and you wanted to buy time to develop therapies, hopefully even a vaccine, but certainly to come up with a more robust testing and tracing and isolating strategy. And it feels though we haven't really done that, but people are ready to return to some version of some normality. And I think we're going to have the state-by-state approach, obviously. I would think we should have really an area-by-area, county-by-county approach in a lot of these states, given how radically different conditions are. And some people will get it right and or get it lucky, and some won't, and we'll learn more about what works. My take on the lockdowns now is there some areas where we just weren't harsh enough. Nursing homes there should have been much more of a focus on them, and a hardening them against this virus would have required probably more tests than we had at the time. But there are just certain counties, you know, you look at New York State, hardest hit area in the country, maybe the world, and there are just parts of New York State basically unaffected by it. So I think we probably had too sweeping approach to the lockdowns. And then also the prohibitions on elective surgeries on a statewide basis, which we've seen in a lot of parts of the country, I also think in retrospect look like a mistake. Obviously, we want the hospitals to have enough equipment and to set up separate areas for COVID patients and all of that. But it's just bizarre that at a time of a global pandemic, you have hospitals in America emptied out, bleeding money, and furloughing staff. So those bans begin to be lifted. As far as I'm concerned, it can't happen fast enough.
Dr. Jha, what do you say to those two points about the elective surgeries and then about, you know, whether the lockdown measures were applied in an appropriate geographic manner?
Yeah, so I actually largely agree with both of those points. I think the context is really important. So when we, stopped doing elective surgeries, there were a couple of reasons, right? One was we didn't know how bad things were going to be and whether the hospitals were going to get overwhelmed. But the second was that most hospitals didn't have enough personal protective equipment. And so we were very worried that if you use them for elective surgeries, you're not going to have them for the ICU doctors and ICU nurses who then will get sick and die. So there's a reason we did this. And basically it was in the context of no planning, we all of a sudden found ourselves facing a tsunami and made a bunch of decisions. And they don't all look perfect in retrospect. And I wish we had made some different ones. But I didn't know that up front, and I think based on the information we had, that was right. I sort of feel similarly about the lockdown, which was, you know, we had such mediocre testing capacity that back in early March, I used to say, I have no idea where the hotspots are. I mean, I know some places are, but if you can't test, you don't know whether upstate New York has a big outbreak or not. And so until you get testing to be at least halfway decent, the safer thing to do is shut stuff down and then open once you can test and get a feel for how big the outbreak is in a given community. So I think more nuanced policy moving forward is exactly right. I think we have a totally different strategy on elective surgeries moving forward, including in the fall, hopefully, even when we have another surge. Hopefully in terms of a new strategy, not hopefully a new surge. I think those are, you know, really reasonable points, but we didn't have any alternatives because we were so caught off guard and flat-footed on this thing.
Christina, it's interesting to me because I think that there are totally valid discussions to have about, you know, where the restrictions were too tight, where they were too loose, how to adjust going forward. But when you compare these, you know, these protests that you're seeing in state capitals, people showing up with guns at the Michigan State Capitol and that sort of thing, when you compare it to the public polling, the public has been remarkably patient about this stuff and seems to generally favor relatively stringent measures here. So I find it interesting how you have this sort of this media conversation that suggests great impatience. And to be clear, I think that, you know, to the extent that we can relax restrictions, I think we should find ways to do that. What we're doing is not sustainable in the long run. But the public almost seems to have more patience for this than opinion leaders rather than less.
Right. Again, I mean, I think as we talked about last week, the public, the general public, people on the street understand that, you know, it's better, in fact, to stay home and not get sick and die. Nobody is enjoying being locked down, but most people do understand the reason behind it. I think the point that you were making about this sort of reopening timeline thing having turned into a partisan battle where apparently believing in COVID is, you know, makes you a liberal simp or something, and that pretending that this disease is a hoax makes you a patriot is ridiculous. And we're seeing that reflected in these protests, which we've also seen have in some cases been seeded and funded by, you know, further right-wing groups looking to stir up acrimony. Most Americans think that those protesters are ridiculous. I certainly think that they are. And, you know, we'll see what happens to them. But I think that we need to pay attention to the people on the ground, the actual science, and not parrying these partisan concerns back and forth.
Dr. Jha, can we talk a little bit about the specifics of what states need to be rolling out in order to have these sustainable reopenings? I mean, we talk about the need for lots of testing. We talk about the need for contact tracing. How much do they need to be testing? Who do they need to be testing? What do these infrastructures look like? And are there states that are getting to the place where they really have what they need?
Yeah, so this is one where the president's plan of opening up America again is, you know, gets it pretty much right. I mean, there's some specific issues where they, you know, punt all the responsibility of testing and tracing to states, which I think is not quite right. But they, you know, talk about a gated approach, right, with this idea that you want to see 14 days of declining case numbers. I think that's absolutely right. You want to have enough testing and tracing, and I'll explain what is enough in this case. And then you want to have a healthcare system that's ready to handle a surge in case you open up and there is a surge. You want to be ready to manage that. So what is enough testing and tracing? It's really about having a good strategy. I think we've talked about some of these things. Like, we clearly need a strategy for doing really extensive testing in nursing homes, prisons, meatpacking plants, places where there have been these big outbreaks. You want to be doing kind of aggressive ongoing testing. Then you want a strategy, and we've kind of laid this out a bit, of you want to start with people who have even mild symptoms. Right now we've been telling them stay at home. And I'm like, no, we actually want to test them because they're often spreading virus. They're often spreading virus before they develop symptoms. And then you go to those people who are positive. You contact trace all of their contacts in the last 5 days or 7 days or 3 days, and there's some disagreement on that. And then you test all those people. And anybody who's positive, you kind of get that going again. If you take that strategy and isolate all the people who are positive, you can keep the burden of disease pretty low in a community. And that means that, you know, people can go about their daily business. And it doesn't mean that we're going to get to go see a baseball game. But it should mean that we should be able to go to a coffee shop and have coffee with a friend or a glass of wine with a, you know, whatever, and go to work. And that's all doable if we build that infrastructure. Massachusetts is making progress. There are a few other states, but no one is there yet. And I wish we had spent all of April building that up so that we could be far more ready in May. And we essentially didn't. And like, I'd like to have that conversation about how do we get ready, not what these protesters are doing in Michigan, which I think is largely a distraction. I mean, again, I understand why we need to talk about it, but they're not helping move the country move forward.
I want to stand up for the Michigan protesters. You know, there was a lot of controversy because some of them were carrying guns, which is ridiculous. There are a couple of Confederate flags. So I watched hours of raw footage of these protests and interviews with the protesters. And you get, you know, some loons, as you do in any gathering of people. But largely what they were just saying is this shouldn't apply. The statewide restriction shouldn't apply all across the state because Detroit is different from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And my small business is being really hurt and I want it to reopen. And that's an entirely legitimate sentiment. And one thing I've really found disturbing this whole debate is just the effort to shut down anyone who has any dissenting or counter view to what the elite consensus is supposed to be at any given time. And obviously science is important, facts and reason are hugely important. But I think just invoking scientific certainty at this moment about this disease is a mistake because there's so much we don't know and still need to know about the virus. And I'll just throw something to the doctor if I could. One thing I wonder about, obviously test and trace and isolate. I mean, that's a classic means of fighting an infectious disease. I just wonder if, you know, a third of the cases are asymptomatic or half, you know, you see different numbers. How much testing do you need to pick up all those asymptomatic cases of people going to have no idea they're sick?
Yeah. So two quick things. I mean, first, on the issue of the Michigan protesters, I think there is no question that we need subtlety in policy. And that's why I, for instance, have been on TV and radio saying, you know, like if Montana wants to open up tomorrow, I think it's pretty reasonable. Like the numbers look pretty good and their testing capacity is fine. I wish it were a little better, but it's okay. Wyoming, Alaska, other states. So I do think we should have a subtle, nuanced policy. And Detroit and New York are different from Montana and Wyoming. And I think that's what we should be doing, is basing it on data. On the issue of asymptomatic, we've been doing a lot of thinking on this. It's really a challenge. And the best numbers we have, I believe, is that maybe about 18% of people are asymptomatic, 18, 20. So let's say 1 in 5. That's a big number. It's not 50. The other big chunk are pre-symptomatic people. So I develop a symptom today, but I might have been shedding virus for the last 2-3 days and infecting people. Those are two different groups that require different strategies. It's very hard to pick up all the asymptomatic people. What I want to do is pick up asymptomatic people in high-risk areas, the nursing homes, the meatpacking places, the prisons. And then I want to get pre-symptomatic people. The moment you have a symptom, I want to go back and contact trace everybody in the last 72 hours to see who you potentially infected. And I know that that strategy will mean I will miss some asymptomatic people. And we're going to have to live with that because we can't do millions and millions of tests. But if we miss a few of those folks, we can still keep our economy open and protect most people. It's sort of we got to do the best we can. It's not going to be perfect. But it's much better than what we're doing right now.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Ashish Jha of the Harvard Global Health Institute. We will be back shortly to talk more about the response to the coronavirus crisis. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. And our special guest is Dr. Ashish Jha, director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. So, Dr. Jha, we've been talking a lot about this sort of regional approach where different states or even different parts of states make different choices about what to reopen and when based on how severe the epidemic is in that place. And partly that's been working because the epidemics have been remaining relatively localized because there's so little long distance travel. Air travel volumes are down more than 90% from where they would be normally. People are not doing long drives for the most part to other parts of the country. But as we reopen, I assume that's going to be less and less the case. There will be more motion, and that means more ability for an outbreak in one place to turn into an outbreak in other places. So is this state-based approach, is that going to keep working as we get more open, or is there going to have to be a more intense federal role there as this becomes less regional outbreaks and more a national epidemic?
Yeah, so let me start off there by saying, undoubtedly, the virus, you know, it's very interesting, right? Because when it was in China, everybody said, well, it's in China. Then it was East Asia, we said, oh, it's just East Asia. Then we all said, well, it's just Europe. Now it's only New York and the cities. It turns out the virus is going to make its way everywhere, including rural America. This is sort of the reality of these things. It just will come more slowly, and it will not spike in the same way. But it will come to places like Montana and Wyoming and Alaska, and it will get sped up as economic activity returns and as interstate travel returns. So we're still going to have to think about a bit more of a coordinated federal response. Again, I'm a big fan of local response. I think states can lead. But the idea that the federal government is just going to sort of take the pandemic off and let the states figure it all out by themselves isn't as effective as if we had a coordinating response from the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, Christine, that goes back to the way the president has talked about this repeatedly, about, you know, that the states are in charge. And obviously the states do have extensive responsibilities here. But I'm skeptical of, you know, even just politically how much it's going to fly for him to basically act like his role here is secondary.
Right. Yeah. So much for that hot second of complete authority over this pandemic. As usual, Trump is trying to brush off his responsibility and, you know, make other people take care of the business that, you know, he should be doing. The federal government, in fact, should be helping to organize the states and their interactions with each other. That is what the federal government is for. I don't think he can brush off that responsibility. I do want to tack back, though, really quickly one more time, and I'm sorry, to these protesters and both what the doctor and Rich were saying. I want to push back against this idea that Rich puts forward that these protesters are just pushing back against some sort of elite consensus that says that COVID-19 is dangerous, or the elite consensus that a shutdown is helpful and valid in keeping people safe. That's not really an elite consensus. That's kind of just the truth. And, you know, maybe the elite consensus means thinking of the well-being of other people, not just your personal preference or having your business open. You know, I kind of want to take a second and just imagine if some of these protesters storming these capitals carrying assault rifles were, you know, Black or people of color, and see if this intimidation, which is not, in fact, reasoned conversation about modulated openings, but just intimidation, would be, you know, taken so jollily and seriously by those on the right. I don't think they would stand for it. And, you know, we should note that so many of these protesters are, you know, they're white, they tend to be from more rural areas, and COVID-19 is falling so much more heavily on the poor and people of color, and those people for whom a rapid ramshackle reopening will force back into work and into dangerous situations. So I think these protesters should be, you know, agitating to build the infrastructure, you know, not flashing their guns so that they can go back to the salon. And I'd like to see if these protests continue when, say, we do have this rushed reopening and then the virus begins to ravage their communities. You know, these lockdowns are for the benefit of everyone, not just everyone's individual preference. And that's something that we have to keep in mind, that we all have to be responsible for each other.
Rich, your own magazine ran a piece this week by Peter Spiliakos, basically contending that the president had made at least a significant political mistake by somewhat associating himself with these reopen movements, that the public opinion polling shows this is not just an elite consensus in favor of these measures, that there is, in fact, a broad public consensus in favor of these measures. And, you know, regarding, you know, you say, you know, you're going to have some loons, that sort of thing. It seems like, you know, it is at least a huge tactical mistake to lead with this form of protest, because yes, there are a lot of people who have complaints about specific aspects of the lockdown rules, and you could definitely say, you know, I should be able to go fishing or that sort of thing. It doesn't seem to me like showing up at the Capitol building with guns is likely to bring people over to your side when you're, if you know, if, as you suggest, the argument is not as unreasonable as it looks from that image.
Yeah, well, the lion's share of the protest was people in their cars driving around the state Capitol honking. I mean, that was a lion's share of it. And they're like 200 people on the Capitol grounds, some of whom had guns, which is idiotic and they shouldn't. But why should, you know, a hardware store owner in a county, rural county somewhere in Michigan, have their livelihood destroyed because Detroit has a terrible problem with this disease? And the fact is, Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan loosened up after these protests, maybe not a cause and effect, but there was a lot of national attention on how ridiculous some of the distinctions she tried to draw were. You know, you could fish from certain kind of boats, but you couldn't fish from motorized boats. You know, that's just absurd. So, and I'm, you know, basically been pro lockdown. I do think we need to take radical measures to save the hospitals and to keep this thing from completely running out of control at the beginning, but it's just not true to deny that there's a huge downside cost to this, you know, and we're journalists, you know, we can work from home, or academics, we can work from home. There are a lot of people who can't, you know, and they're unemployed now, and their businesses that are on the brink of destruction. That's a real serious cost. And the idea that if you focus on that, that you're somehow a malefactor who wants people to die and doesn't care about what's happening in our cities strikes me as ridiculous.
Dr. Jobb, one aspect of this that I've been wondering about is, you know, this is going to go on for some time, and it is quite possible that there are going to be reimpositions of certain orders, certain restrictions as events arise in various parts of the country. And right now, the public opinion polling suggests, you know, a lot of public patience with these measures. But I don't know the extent to which that's going to persist. And it's not just a matter of what rules you put down. It's a matter of whether the public complies with those rules. So what does that mean for policymakers as they're trying to ensure that members of the public will follow orders and will follow recommendations as we go forward? I mean, for example, there's been this huge shift on, you know, you shouldn't wear a mask and then you should wear a mask, but top administration officials are still going out and not wearing masks, even when, you know, the official guidance is encouraging people to do that. So what is the outlook for sort of long run public cooperation of the sort that we'll need to make the fight against this virus work?
Yeah, it's a great question. And let me actually just very quickly respond to something Rich just said, which I agree with, that there's been this enormous cost of the shutdown. Just awful economically, but also from a health point of view. The thing that's been really interesting to me is how little interest there has been on the right, or really anywhere, to hold the administration accountable for one fiasco after another that led to this. And so for people who say this is terrible, the shutdown over the last month, my response is we all saw it coming. Like everybody, every public health person, the administration, its own security people. So is there no interest in saying, A, we're going to hold people accountable for one of the biggest fiascos in American history, certainly modern history? And second, are we not going to bother to learn lessons so we don't do this again in the summer and fall? Because the virus is coming back. It's not going away. And, you know, in terms of the American people's compliance with these things, it's been really interesting to watch the data that people stopped going to restaurants days before the restaurant shutdown orders happened. People don't need their governors to tell them, hey, don't get sick and die. People would prefer not to get sick and die on their own. And so if the data in the community is that infection rates are rising, hospitals are seeing a lot more cases, people are starting to get really sick and die, I think people will be compliant. They'll get more and more angry that those are the choices they have. to me, the response of the people will really depend on their level of confidence in engaging with the economy and their fear of getting sick and the trade-off between the two. And, you know, I am one of the few kind of people in the public health world who believe that there is a way to thread this needle where we can have our economy and keep people alive and healthy. But it's going to take extraordinary execution on part of the government. And I would love it if we could all agree, whatever our philosophical beliefs, that an effective government is a necessity in a pandemic and not just a nice to have. And that's what I feel like we're not doing. We're not discussing how we make sure that our government is effective in responding to this pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, to Dr. Jha's point there about the public takes these steps on their own, it seems to me that implicitly or even sometimes explicitly in what you're hearing from Republican politicians is the need to push back on that instinct through public policy. You have right now, Senator Mitch McConnell has made a top priority that there should be some sort of indemnification for businesses as they reopen if their workers get coronavirus. Basically, the idea there is to stop people from making their own prudential decisions that I don't want to reopen because I'm afraid that someone's going to get sick at my business and I'm going to sue. You're seeing states making decisions about the enhanced unemployment benefits, which are available under a much broader than usual set of circumstances, including people who have had to quit their jobs because of the crisis. You have governors saying that they're going to take efforts to ensure that, you know, when the states have reopened, if people have jobs available to them, they will no longer be able to collect those unemployment benefits, even if they're concerned about the health implications of going back. And so I'm actually interested in what both Rich and Christine think about that, because you know it seems to me that is trying to suppress what is generally a healthy instinct. I also think the focus on lawsuit liability is a little weird, because you know I'm afraid that someone will get sick at my business and I'll be sued is a second order concern. The first order concern is I'm afraid someone will get sick at my business. People have lots of reasons other than lawsuits to be reluctant to open for that reason. And so I'm wondering about, you know, is this really the right lever to be pushing to try to get the country open, to basically, you know, use carrots and sticks to make people feel they must go out and work even if they don't think that the health conditions support that?
Right. So I think that's an incredible point, and one that, yeah, we need to be banging that drum much more loudly. I think one thing that we need to remember, and that isn't spoken enough, is that the choice between having a lockdown that destroys businesses and livelihoods or opening the country back up so that more people get sick and die is a choice that we have forced on ourselves, or rather that this government has forced on us. There could be another option, an option in which the government, which is, you know, honestly printing money at this point, puts that money towards supporting people, supporting their payrolls, perhaps giving them a basic income for a short period of time, perhaps making sure that healthcare costs are covered so that people are not worried about getting sick, makes it possible for people to stay home and still be able to keep their businesses, still be able to run their families, still not disappear under mountains of debt. We just haven't decided to do that. And the right, conservatives, seem perfectly fine with making the choice economy or death, with nothing about supporting citizens' health and safety in between.
Well, that's an amazing straw man. It's just not true. These bipartisan bills have passed Congress pushing enormous amounts of money out the door. But I do think we need to think about, you know, what's the standard for the lockdowns? Initially, it was buy time, keep the hospitals from being overwhelmed. The hospitals haven't been overwhelmed. If we're going to go to a standard of there's not going to be one new case or one new death of coronavirus, we're going to destroy the country in the course of trying to save it. Now, I take the point of the doctor and you too, Josh, that people really voted with their feet prior to the formal lockdowns. They were scared. They wanted to stay home, travel less, be out less. There's some indication, some research out there suggesting this actually emergency declarations that might have had the most effect rather than the actual lockdowns, because people changed their behavior prior to the lockdowns. And you know, the other side of the ledger is going to work as well. We can say, a state can say it's reopened, but if people don't think they can go about their business pretty safely, they're not going to go about their business, and the consumers aren't going to return in force. So I take that point entirely.
Dr. Jha, I'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah. So again, I think we've just set up this really silly trade-off between death and economy in a way that has just never made any sense to me. I mean, the way I look at it is, and again, obviously the goal is not to prevent every single death. I mean, that'd be great, but that's not realistic. And economic shutdowns have huge health effects. So I get that. The thing that I worry about is if we open up quickly and imprudently, you will see a rise in cases, again, basic biology, and states are going to have a hard time keeping up with it. And the idea that people will be going out to restaurants and bars and getting on a plane and going to Disney World when there are large numbers of people dying in their community and hospitals starting to fill up again and doctors and nurses are getting sick, to me, is an economic fantasy. And so this is the wrong choice. The right choice is we do know how to get away with like keeping our economy reasonably open and keeping people's lives, you know, saving people's lives. And that is a really aggressive test, trace, isolate strategy, maintain some amount of modest social distancing, work on vaccines and therapies. That's it. That's the entire list. And if we're not talking about those things, then we're getting distracted. And I would really like all of us across the entire political spectrum to focus on all of those things. And then we can fight about, you know, other stuff later.
Ashish Jha is professor of global health and director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Dr. Jha, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Christine Embo, what's your rant?
I'm ranting against time. It's been 8 weeks since I've been locked down, and I don't mind it. I mean, I do mind it. I would rather not be locked down. I hate it, but I understand it. But I do hate how time has been acting. It's so slippery and so disagreeable. It's lengthening when I don't want it to, and it's shrinking when I need more of it. Time is flying, never to return, as Virgil wrote, and I resent it.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
We've had new revelations in the false statements case against Michael Flynn, the former Trump national security advisor. It looks increasingly as if the FBI didn't have any legitimate predicate for investigating Michael Flynn. The FBI agents who actually interviewed him may have believed that he was truthful. And it seems as though Flynn was bullied into his plea deal over legal threats made against his son. The left for 50 years now has been concerned about, to the point of obsession, potential FBI abuses. It should exhibit some interest in this one.
For my rant, every Thursday, the Department of Labor has been putting out statistics on the number of unemployment claims for initial unemployment that are being filed. And the numbers are absolutely staggering. Many millions of people every week, 7 million, 4 million week to week. Another number that they put out every week that gets less attention is called insured unemployment. This is the percentage of the workforce that is receiving unemployment benefits. That is 11.2% as of the most recent data for the week ending April 11th, which is an extremely high number. It reflects both the terrible economic situation that we are in and the unprecedented efforts by the government to expand the availability of unemployment. But while you have that 11% number nationally, there is huge variation from state to state. In Michigan, 21% of the workforce is receiving unemployment. In Florida, it's just 2%. That's not because the labor market is great in Florida. It's not because everyone in Florida has a job. It's because it is so difficult to obtain unemployment benefits in Florida. These systems are run by the states, and Florida made an intentional decision under Governor Rick Scott to make it difficult to get unemployment benefits so the unemployment system would be less expensive for employers. And we're seeing the consequence of that now. You have all these people in Florida who are out of work. The federal government has appropriated money that is supposed to be available to support them while they're out of work, and their state government has massively failed them. And while Florida is the worst, there are a number of other states that are also doing very poorly here. It is a huge failure of government, and it is something that needs to be fixed for the next time that we have a crisis like this. That's all I have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Christine Emba, and Dr. Ashish Jha. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.